Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, David Onick. Our topic this hour is neighborhood journalism in San Francisco. What's the most reliable and up-to-date source of local news these days? For many San Francisco residents, it's not the Chronicle or the Bay Guardian or the SF Weekly, but instead the array of neighborhood blogs that track restaurant openings, follow housing and zoning debates, report on crime, and highlight the individuals and happenings that make each San Francisco neighborhood so unique. This evening, we'll speak with some of the citizen journalists who create and manage these blogs about life on the neighborhood beat. Where do they find their sources and material? How do they keep their enterprises afloat financially? How have their neighborhoods changed since they've begun reporting? And is hyperlocal journalism here to stay? Joining me in studio to discuss these issues and more are Todd Lappin, founder and editor of Bernalwood, a blog about San Francisco's Bernal Heights neighborhood. Todd also leads community outreach efforts for magazine makers on Flipboard, an app that aggregates web content and presents it as a personalized online magazine. Welcome, Todd.
Thank you.
Rose Garrett, managing editor of Hoodline, a neighborhood blog focused on the Haight, Hayes Valley, and Nopa neighborhoods. Rose is also the associate editor of Eater SF, the restaurant and food blog. Welcome, Rose.
Thank you.
Kevin Montgomery, founder and editor of Uptown Almanac, a blog about San Francisco culture and politics, principally focused on the Mission District. Kevin is also a staff writer for ValleyWag, Gawker Media's tech blog. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you.
And joining us by phone is Roy McKenzie, founder and editor of The Castro Biscuit, a news, politics, and arts blog about the Castro. Roy is also a front-end web developer. Welcome, Roy.
Thank you very much.
Later in the show, we will invite you, our listeners, to call in and join our conversation. You can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website at kalw.org. Well, we have a great group of people here to talk about this topic, and I want to start by asking each of you, why did you start your neighborhood blog? Three of the four of you are actually the founders as well as the editors. Let's start with you, Todd.
Mine was sort of a fit of pique and frustration, just that sort of – I didn't really feel like Bernal Heights was receiving the coverage of the neighborhood that I live in. The mainstream newspapers basically ignore it. The neighborhood does have an existing print newspaper, but its politics weren't necessarily aligned with my own, and I felt like it was sort of very focused on its own agenda and sort of missing the larger context of the neighborhood. And I just sort of started, and next thing I know, I'm still doing it a couple years later. It's one of those little things that you started on a whim, and a couple years later, you find yourself staying up till midnight every night working on it.
When you say a couple of years, what year did you start?
Bernalwood's about 3.5 years old, I believe.
Okay. And Rose, what about you? What got you into this?
Well, I think, like a lot of people, I sort of had a day job that was not necessarily fulfilling all of my creative inclinations. And at the time, I was and still am living in the Lower Haight, and there was a blog called Haiteration in the Lower Haight. And about 3 years ago, I emailed Andrew Dudley, who was the founder of that blog, and asked him if I could help out. He seemed like he was running the thing all by himself. And he said, sure, please, I need all the help I can get. And from then on, it was just sort of a side project up until I started freelancing full-time about a year ago. And, yeah.
And what about you, Kevin Montgomery?
Yeah, I got into it starting in 2010, and basically that was a really interesting time in the Mission District. I mean, obviously, the tech resurgence was just starting to happen, which was putting a lot of demand on housing. Also, you had a lot of interesting things starting to happen on Valencia Street with sort of the restaurant boom. And I just kind of looked at it and saw, you know, similar story to what everyone else is saying. You know, the neighborhood beats largely died down in the daily papers, and I sort of felt like the existing sort of local landscape was kind of not really focusing on the change that was happening, but was sort of just focusing on the aesthetics of what was happening in the Mission. I kind of wanted to dive a little bit deeper and just, you know, talk about what was going on.
Roy, what about you? Why did you start the Castro Biscuit?
Well, I started the Biscuit because I moved here about 3 years ago, and I wanted to get, like, connected with my neighborhood and find out what was going on. And I didn't realize that there was already a print edition happening in the neighborhood, but I was introduced to it, and it didn't have a good online presence. And I really wanted to set up a blog because I had been reading about I had been reading Haiteration, and I was really inspired by just uh, the kind of like, for lack of a better word, minutiae that we could cover, and being interesting to other people as far as like a restaurant opening or the issue that really got me worked up that I wanted to write about was the nudity ban in the Castro, because I had moved to San Francisco to get out of the Central Valley, which was a little bit conservative for me, and I was upset that this was happening. So I didn't feel like I had a voice. I didn't know where to turn to have my voice heard. So I decided to create the blog, and that was the starting story for it, and it just took off from there.
Roy, it's interesting that you moved here 3 years ago, because you kind of think of these as people who have longstanding roots in the community and really know the community well. How were you able to establish trust and legitimacy as someone who had moved here recently, where now you have a local blog that's read by and respected by many, many people?
I think there's a couple factors that weigh in, and one of the main ones that I want to also give a shout out to is my co-writer, who is taking a break for now, but Wade Palmer. He had a lot of connections in the city, and he did a lot of writing for the Castro Biscuit in the middle of starting it, and he's been around here around the city for 10, 15, 20 years, I think. So he really connected me with different resources, and other than that, I think that just having an open comment section where everyone feels like they can contribute, and not censoring that as much as possible, and having a Facebook presence immediately and being active on Twitter, people respond to that, and they want to communicate, and they want to submit stories. And if they feel like they're part of the process, they're more apt to trust and listen and engage.
Kevin, let me ask you, we all know that daily newspapers around the country are downsizing significantly. The Chronicle is no exception. So there are less reporters out there, and certainly the local beat is something that is typically not a priority. What are the types of things that you might cover that you just wouldn't see in the San Francisco Chronicle?
I mean, I think a really good example is, you know, the case of Adobe Books was a story that was being really just thoroughly ignored. They had a for rent sign above their business for well over a year, and, you know, no one really thought to think, why was this longstanding business being pushed out of the neighborhood? And so, you know, this was a story that I went after, and it turned out that Liz Claiborne's subsidiary, Jack Spade, was basically financing their eviction. And ultimately, that led to Adobe having to relocate to 24th Street, like a lot of other independent businesses around the neighborhood, and also and ultimately led to Jack Spade being blocked within City Hall through multiple protests. And I think as larger dailies sort of move away from neighborhoods and focus more on citywide and regional news, they kind of lose touch with these communities and therefore have to react to news as it's breaking on local blogs, you know, not just mine, but Bernalwood has done this with a number of cases, most recently the Presidio Park issue being included in Cali 2024. And I think in a way that they end up using us as a resource, but, you know, without us, these stories might not get uncovered at all.
When the mainstream media does pick up a story you started, are you typically credited with breaking the story?
Never. It does happen. Usually if we once in a while, when it breaks through a larger blog, they will typically credit another blog. And when it breaks that way, they'll often mention the original source. But if it goes straight to the dailies, they'll pretend like we don't exist.
And when you said you would, you went after the story, are you able to get credentials to be treated like a member of the press if you need, say, access to a City Hall hearing or something like that?
Well, fortunately, San Francisco government makes it really easy for any person to attend a City Hall meeting. So in those cases, I've never needed access. Fortunately, the San Francisco Police Department, through bloggers that are not even on the scene anymore, they put a lot of legwork in the early 2000s, making sure SFPD responded to bloggers. So fortunately, San Francisco is really progressive in media access, in my opinion. you know, with politicians, it's sort of a mixed bag. Progressives are typically a lot more engaged with online media, and I think that's partly because online media tends to be more sympathetic towards progressives, whereas some supervisors I find will never respond to media inquiries. So I'd say that's sort of the, in my opinion, the last frontier really is getting politicians to give us respect and answer our calls.
Rose, do you have the same issue with politicians?
Yes and no. It's sort of a case-by-case basis. I mean, I think a lot of times if you say you're calling from the Chronicle, that's a name recognition issue right there. And if you say you're calling from Uptown Almanac or Hoodline, you know, a lot of people just don't really know what those are. And hopefully that might change soon. I don't know.
And same question I asked Kevin. What's the type of story that you cover that you would not see in the San Francisco Chronicle?
Well, I think we have a big opportunity to cover some more sort of folksy news that the Chronicle would not pick up, but that local residents really care about, like a big new mural going up or a bunch of new trees being planted. You know, this is not breaking hard news type material, but, you know, sometimes we run stories that we think are just, you know, I don't know, definitely softballs, and people are just up in arms with their opinions, pro and con, and how dare you say that about, you know, this. So there's really a community there that's really, really longing to be engaged on even the most seemingly tiny issue.
And Roy, let me go to you, because on that point of trees, I know that you have been covering kind of DPW's work in the Castro, which is the type of thing that the rest of the city might be like, you know, who cares where DPW is working now? But if you live in the Castro or spend time in the Castro, it's a huge deal to know when is this construction going to be done so we can go about our daily lives again.
Yeah, sure. I know that with the Castro Streetscape Improvement Project, which is at a hard stop right now for Pride, all the construction crews have moved the fences, so now we have big sidewalks. The sidewalks aren't completely finished, but they had to move them so that as soon as Pink Saturday comes, all the out-of-towners come in and celebrate, they'll have a space to walk in and be able to enter the shops. I went to all the meetings that the Department of Public Works had before they actually got final design and construction done, and I reported on that for the blog, and a lot of people appreciate that because they could not make it to these meetings. Usually they were right after work or they have families and they can't make it, so I would basically write an outline of what happened so that they could make their voice heard, and to some degree, you know, the Castro Community Benefit District that what also had its own hand in the planning, came to the website, they listened to the concerns of the community, and they brought back those concerns and to the Department of Public Works. And also one of the more contentious items recently was the rainbow crosswalks. Now, a lot of people throughout the United States, like, they think it's great that the Castro is getting rainbow crosswalks. However, everyone in the Castro is really upset about the fact that we're getting rainbow crosswalks because they see it as a Disneyfication of the Castro. And I had posts about it where I received like 30 or 40 commenters just angry about it, and in really heated debates. So it was really interesting to see that and be part of that process.
Todd, let me get this to you as well. Bernalwood covers – what does Bernalwood cover that we wouldn't otherwise see?
Well, there's a bunch of things. I mean, Bernalwood is – one of the things I've really enjoyed about Bernalwood is the amount of whimsy that it allows me. So, you know, there's a lot of things that we cover that are kind of
random.
Perennial stories. You know, I always joke that anything about parking is sort of like the Miley Cyrus of Bernalwood. You know, just the traffic goes through the roof. You know, just anything having to do with parking. Ridiculous notes people find on their windshield. But, I mean, what I love about this is the San Francisco that we all live. This is the city that we actually participate in. The reason and you know, as much as I joke about parking as being the Miley Cyrus of Bernalwood, It's totally legit. I mean, this is the stuff that people's lives are consumed by. You know, the space in front of your house where you park is something that you literally engage with every day. you know, there's other things that, you know, we have sort of Bernal has what I call our Sasquatch, which is the bikini jogger, who is a woman who jogs regularly in a bikini. We don't know who she is. We don't want to know who she is, but we love when people send these kind of Sasquatch-like, you know, fleeting photos of her sort of zipping across the landscape. It's things like that which I think really help create the characters that make a neighborhood really feel like a place. And, you know, no traditional newspaper is going to cover that. Bernalwood, again, is often very whimsical, but somebody says something wonderful, which I love about it, which is, you know, Bernalwood is fun and entertaining, except sometimes it's serious. And I you know, find that very rewarding, that I can sort of, you know, literally, quite obviously, make up a story one day, and it's obviously fictitious, and then the next day we can tackle something that's pretty serious, and that people can sort of make that transition pretty easily. It's very liberating, and it's actually what keeps the thing interesting for me.
How important is the online presence? Because there were traditional neighborhood newspapers. The Noe Valley Voice is one example. That was a print newspaper that covered local issues. I think it's maybe monthly. You're just a neighborhood over in Bernal. How does online change that dynamic?
Well, this is where actually I think this is where we really get into something new that doesn't compare to what any of the traditional you know, print-based papers. First, I have a print background. I was a print magazine editor for 15 years, so I definitely understand and love print. But Bernalwood is also extremely community-powered. You know, I have a day job. Bernalwood's something that I do before I go to bed at night. And I'm very dependent on the neighborhood for the reporting. And so, you know, a lot of the posts that that are on Bernalwood are really just people in the neighborhood who happen to take a picture and send me an email, and a lot of what I'm doing is just packaging that up. That's something you really can only do effectively in an online context, both where the social context for that exists. In other words, the idea of quoting and attribution is something that's sort of native to online and people don't find that strange at all. And also in terms of the instantaneity of it, that if something actually happens, there's been plenty of times when Bernalwood's been able to break news at a pace faster than any traditional media ever has. And again, and I've been doing nothing more than sitting in my living room and letting, you know, my neighbors be the reporters. So there's a lot of things that it's able to do because it's online that really just sort of not only define it, but really sort of give it a lot of its character.
This is City Visions on local public radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight we're discussing neighborhood journalism with my guests, Todd Lappin, founder and editor of Bernalwood, Rose Garrett, managing editor of Hoodline, Kevin Montgomery, founder and editor of Uptown Almanac, and Roy McKenzie, founder and managing editor of the Castro Biscuit. We now invite you to call in with your questions or comments. What neighborhood blogs do you read, and why? Are there any hyper-local issues you'd like to see covered in neighborhood blogs? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website, kalw.org. We do have an email that came in from Carl. I love the idea of ultra-local papers and used to really enjoy reading the Richmond Review until the editor went on his bizarre rant-filled editorial campaign against public transportation. I guess that's one of the dangers of ultra-local papers, i.e. having no significant buffers against being used as a megaphone for the editor's views, no matter how idiosyncratic. And I would add to that not only the editors, but we talk some about commenters. So I would love for you all to weigh in on that. Are you trying to give unbiased news, or are you giving your own editorial slant to this information, and is it hard when there's no filter? Let's start with you, Kevin.
I mean, I think it's – you basically have to sort of – I don't like picking – or I don't like being unbiased. I think it's really important to sort of pick a side and make sure people know, because that way they kind of can understand my own bias and where I'm coming from, as opposed to me presenting an unbiased opinion and in effect sort of like trying to sneak my own opinions in. And in a way, I think it does limit your audience and it does open you up for some criticism. But at the end of the day, like, it's transparent. Like, everyone knows where I stand on most of the issues I'm talking about, especially around housing. And there's, you know, no one has to be confused about that. In some respect, though, I think that can end up turning into the comment section into sort of this bizarre, you know, sort of cesspool of people just trying to, like, ultimately sort of fighting in the context of the way I frame something. So often, like, if I talk about a new condo development, the, you know, I'll sort of inject my opinion into it. And then that sort of frames the discussion in a way that might, I'm not sure, is always the most conducive. You know, I can think of one example where it sort of turned into this thing about, like, people accusing Latinos of being xenophobic against, you know, white people moving the mission. I didn't find that to be very appropriate or accurate. But, you know, you're faced with this weird position where you're either trying to, you know, censor your commenters or you just let it stand. So,
well, how do you handle that? Do you all, I'd like to hear from each of you, do you moderate the comment section? And if so, what is the standard? Or do you just let whatever goes up there stay, no matter how vile it might be? Rose?
I mean, yeah, I think this is a discussion that we've definitely had. And it's something that, you know, both sides of view are valid in terms of, we definitely want to avoid racist, misogynistic, you know, that kind of language is not really appropriate, especially for Hoodline. We want to be a space where, you know, potentially even kids could read the site and it wouldn't be an unfriendly environment for them. And I think that's where having sort of a critical mass of readers and commenters comes in handy because, you know, when you're first starting out, you might have one or two commenters who are coming at an issue from a really intense standpoint. But when you have a lot of commenters, the comments can sort of self-moderate where people are, you know, saying one thing and then other people are kind of making a valid argument against them. And at the end of the day, what we've found is most stories kind of come to a natural equilibrium in terms of the comments. You know, we have certain characters who we know who will come back again and again, and, you know, we certainly have our inside jokes about them and also appreciate...
Do people need to identify themselves by name or can they have a pseudonym when they're posting?
No, they can have a pseudonym. You know, we appreciate that and we appreciate strong opinions and we think it really does lend itself to adding a sense of community in a discussion around issues, no matter how mundane. But certainly if it crosses a certain line, we will, you know, take that off.
Todd?
Yeah, I sort of have a very similar philosophy. You know, I sort of have a default moderation policy, so your first comment is moderated. And I find that people who are basically not inclined to make constructive dialogue will do that from the very beginning. So it's very straightforward. You can sort of recognize the troublemakers from the very beginning. After that, my philosophy has been, you know, strong opinions are good, salty opinions are good. Anything that involves a personal attack on another commenter is not okay. So as long as the focus is on discussion and argumentation, even if that discussion can be difficult, it's okay as long as everybody's not just sort of pointing fingers and calling each other names.
Roy, what about you?
I kind of do what Todd does as well. As soon as someone submits a comment, they have to verify that they actually have that email address and post it and kind of own it. And, you know, run the risk of being called out if they say something really mean or salacious. And one time I did a review of a new restaurant that just opened up in the Castro, about a year ago. Anyway, a commenter who doesn't really care for me that much wrote on there, next time you do a review, don't get paid by the restaurant to do the review. And I don't get paid to do any of this stuff.
Yeah, we're going to get to that in a moment, actually.
Yeah. So I posted a receipt on there, and it was just relentless back and forth. I couldn't lend any credibility to myself that this guy would believe, and it was just back and forth. And I've learned since then, kind of like hands off and do not engage. And the crazy people who comment will comment, and the people who want to add constructive dialogue will. And I implemented this, like, thumbs up, thumbs down voting for each comment. And if a comment receives more than 5 thumbs down, then it automatically hides. You can still view the comment, but you have to click a little link to for it to be revealed. So there's some self-moderation with everyone who come who comes to the site and views the post and views the comments, they can engage without actually making a comment. They can vote down a comment or vote up a comment. And the voted up comments also are highlighted with a yellow background. So it's interesting.
Do you, for all of you, do you talked about not getting paid for this, and I do want to get into that, but do you all view this as a community service that you're performing? Rose, I see you nodding your head.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I don't think anyone gets into hyper-local news to make money. I think it's definitely sort of a labor of love that you do. I mean, anyone who's been a reader of Hateration or Uppercasing or Hayeswire, which are the Lower Hate, Upper Hate, and Hayes Valley blogs that sort of are all rolled into Hoodline now. They know that we've been running for, you know, a few years, and the editors of those blogs have been around for a while, and everyone has their day job. Everyone's doing it because they want to contribute. They want to be involved in the community. There's a real need there, I think. And, you know, it's also just kind of a fun thing to do. I mean, some days it's not fun, but a lot of times if you like to write and you want to take photos and you want to talk to people and learn about the neighborhood, it's a really fantastic thing to do, you know, on weekends and evenings and whenever you can make it happen.
I wouldn't want to say community service, but it does serve in a way as like a community bulletin board, especially in the comment sections. I'd say labor of love is definitely the way I feel, but it's really interesting how I think it can sort of steer you into, you know, if you really find yourself enjoying it, like steer you into a sort of full-time career in writing. You know, I know through like the, you know, 5.5 years I've been sort of writing in the Mission, like I've been taking jobs that would be more part time so I could focus more on writing about, you know, the Mission and surrounding neighborhoods. And, you know, I think that's sort of an interesting new model is, you know, depending, like I didn't go into this for this reason, but I've seen people that have that, you know, instead of journalism school, they just end up writing a local blog for a couple of years. And, you know, I think if you're dedicated enough, you can kind of come out of it with the exact same background that you would get in a journalism, mm-hmm. you know, university.
The thing that I find really interesting that I mean, definitely this is a nonprofit thing, not even trying. But, you know, and this sounds really corny, but I say it all the time when I talk about it, is I feel like I've genuinely been compensated by the relationships I've made. You know, the neighborhood has become a very real place for me. You know, I do live here. So, you know, it's really great to be able to know who that merchant is and to know the person who made that thing happen. And, you know, there's plenty of things that this happens pretty routinely. I'm sitting around a table with a bunch of people enjoying dinner or a drink, and I realize I only know these people because of the blog. You know, like I've already forgotten that was the original tie. But it's, you know, it's because of the blog that I've sort of made so many really, really great friends. And, you know, that, again, sounds completely corny, but it's a very real form of compensation. You know, and then the blog definitely, Bernalwood does function. The neighborhood needs something like it, something which has more of a real-time metabolism, something where people can react and sort of vent and, you know, discuss. You know, so there is a real need for that sort of a thing right now.
This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing neighborhood journalism with my guests, Todd Lappin of Bernalwood, Rose Garrett of Hoodline, Kevin Montgomery of Uptown Almanac, and Roy McKenzie of the Castro Biscuit. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment on our website, klw.org. We do have an email that just came in. Do you see hyperlocal news coverage expanding into the use of video coverage? And as a follow-up, at what point do journalistic ethical practices come into play? That's really a two-parter. I know all of your sites do use photos quite a bit. In fact, almost every post has a photo, which I think is one of the unique characteristics. Have you begun incorporating video into your coverage? Anybody? I see a lot of head shaking.
At the end of the day, like, I mean, we all talked about how this is, you know, sort of a hobby for a lot of us, and at the end, it just takes so much time to put together video, and I just find it too technically challenging. Mm-hmm. You know, when you don't have a budget, you can't hire someone to help you with that.
I agree with Kevin. I sometimes run into readers who will send me a video, or for instance, there was a fire at the a funeral service place across the street from me here in the Castro, and it was huge, and it was at night, and there was a lot of people out with their cell phones and taking pictures, and I stood next to one guy who had his video camera going, and I ended up knowing this guy from some other stuff I was doing, and I asked him, hey, can you like send me that video on via text or something so I can post it onto the blog, because it was a huge explosion and everyone was, what is going on? And so I never have time, like Kevin said, to put together a video. It would be mostly just found footage, and I love being able to do that, but most of the time, the news, I'm not able to go to it when it happens. And a lot of the news that I do cover is related to a business opening, and there's not a lot of video footage. I guess you could get creative and tell a story and go visit the business after they've opened, but a lot of it's like, a lot of what I do as far as reporting is pre, you know, opening, I guess, or it's before, before the business would open.
I use a little bit of video on Bernalwood, but for the most part, I don't necessarily think it's a very efficient way to do storytelling. You know, I think a photo and a headline can actually do as much as a lot of video, but and obviously there's some bandwidth issues. But on the ethics question, that is a very interesting mm-hmm. Topic. You know, I'd basically hold the blog to the same standards that I used when I was a professional journalist. I don't let any of the merchants, you know, give me anything more than maybe a cupcake once in a while, and they want to, but you know, just no, it's just not the way it's done. I do think that the standards have to apply, because at the end of the day, and I think everybody here will probably agree, if you do not maintain the integrity of the site, it's just not going to be a trusted resource for your community. It just, you know, people have to believe in it, and in order for that belief to be present, you have to, you know, follow, you know, sort of basic journalistic practice. Even if you're not doing a whole lot of actual reporting yourself, even if you're sort of assembling on some level, the objectivity and the sort of neutrality and the lack of conflict of interest has to be present.
Yeah, I find this a lot. I think a lot of people assume that blogs aren't trustworthy because they're not backed by an official organization, but I completely agree with Todd. Like, you know, once in a while, like, I've gotten a story wrong before where I'll get a tip and I'll post it, and you know, someone will debunk it, and, like, you know, I'll post immediately a retraction, but, you know, I think people, you know, that's an example of, like, well, we're holding ourselves to a standard here. If we get something wrong, we want to, you know, set the record straight. And I think a lot of people just believe that, you know, bloggers aren't trustworthy. They'll post whatever they want. And I've never found that to be true. I find most stories I read in almost all the San Francisco blogs hold up to scrutiny.
And one thing I've noticed, too, I mean, we were talking earlier a little bit about, you know, what happens when a story that you break on your blog gets picked up by a larger sort of media source. And I would certainly agree that a lot of times there's zero attribution. And I would say that within the sort of local online blog network, we do a way better job of that, where we really credit each other with the work and the reporting we've done, which I'd say kind of goes above and beyond some of the stuff I've seen on, you know, more mainstream news sites. So that's something that I'm proud of.
I do think, like, that's part of our job. You know, again, I've worked at the higher levels of the media food chain, and it's great to be at the bottom. You know, I think that's the way it works. Like, you know, part of our job is to surface the things that more traditional outlets might not otherwise find. In fact, my biggest frustration is when they don't pick up the things when I sort of feel like I just served it to them on a silver platter. And, you know, they can credit me or not credit me, but this is a great story. Why aren't you running with it? That I find more exasperating than the issue of attribution.
Let me also pick up on something Kevin raised earlier, which is saying instead of trying to be the neutral journalist to say, yeah, I do have an opinion, but I'm just going to be totally transparent about it. So then you can take what I have to say however you want to. Is that the way the two of you in studio here, Rose and Todd, approach your work as well? As long as you're transparent, it's okay to be coming from a certain viewpoint?
Well, Hoodline, I think, takes a bit more of a traditional tone in terms of we do try to stay pretty objective, and we also do have a bit more of a traditional structure where we have neighborhood editors and writers, and I edit their stories. So, you know, it kind of goes through that process where I'm able to kind of eliminate bias as best I can or kind of enable it in a constructive way. But I could see us running, you know, more of an op-ed style of post in the future. It's not something we've really done in the past. But as for us, we're a little bit more on the kind of objective, traditional side of that spectrum.
And where does Bernalwood fall?
Well, I come from a magazine background, not a newspaper background. And so that means, you know, in a nutshell, that I'm very comfortable with the idea of having a clear point of view. I don't necessarily aspire to objectivity. I just aspire to be consistent about the point of view. Some of Bernalwood's point of view is ridiculous. The notion that Bernalwood is fashion obsessed is obviously absurd. But but a lot of it is there's also Bernalwood has a very strong YIMBY orientation, which is to say like very positive towards change and towards the change that is happening in San Francisco, and that's a point of view. The most important thing about these things is that I think that you're consistent about them so that people know what to expect. If you don't really want to tune into something and have it be a weather vane every single day.
I would also say it's not totally about just like getting out my point of view, but you know, as someone that can't dedicate their entire day, this isn't my day job, you don't have the time to go source quotes from everyone. So typically the way mainstream media has handled controversy is by, you know, getting opposing quotes.
Right.
And if you don't have the time to do that, it's just a lot easier to say, this is where I'm coming from, and, you know, hash it out in the comments if you disagree.
Great. Let's now go to the phones. We have Margaret from San Francisco. Margaret, welcome to City Visions.
Hi. My name is Margaret. I live in Bernal Heights on the North Slope, and I love Bernalwood. And, you know, I never even questioned the integrity of it, but I do appreciate the consistent point of view that Todd has, and I get so much information on that. I just get so much information that I wouldn't otherwise get. And I really appreciate that. And I want to thank you for that.
Thank you, Margaret. That's really, really great to hear. Again, I just got paid, so that's terrific. I will say one thing about point of view, and there's one thing I always regret, is whenever I have waded into politics, I have regretted it. Just because the backlash and the emotions that it conjures are so strong. Sometimes I can't help myself and I do wade into those discussions, but I got to say every time I do it, I kind of have to take a shower and take a break for a week because it ends up being very controversial. And the thing, what I really don't like about it, where I think it really does sort of get in the way of what Bernalwood's about, is Bernalwood's about trying to make the neighborhood feel more together, to bring us more together, whereas politics tends to very quickly factionalize us. So it is something that I try and avoid, but again, and Margaret's comment is great. I mean, that's really what this is about, is trying to make the neighborhood feel like everybody has a better handle on what's going on around them and hopefully having a good time along the way.
And we do have a good time.
All right. Thank you very much for the call, Margaret. I want to ask, because you all talked about the lack of resources you have, if you had more resources, are there certain types of stories you would want to cover, you would want to write about, but you just don't have the bandwidth to do that now? What are the types of things you would cover if you had more resources?
I think I would just go more in depth. I mean, every morning I wake up and I put together a story list, and I would say I'm only able to write about 30% of what I would like to write about every day. And it's not, you know, at a certain point, it's just triage. You know, I can write 2 posts today, I can write 3 posts today, and you just pick the ones that you're the most passionate about or you think are the most important. But that doesn't mean the rest of the stories aren't as important. So there's a lot of, you know, I, for example, I've totally let go of restaurant reviews, which is something I used to really enjoy doing because I feel like the housing crisis and the Mission has taken, you know, precedence over what restaurants are opening. That's not to say talking about what restaurants our opening isn't interesting or important to the community. It's just, you know, you only have so much bandwidth. So I think, you know, I think it's just being able to get to what you would what you have to neglect.
Yeah, I think this takes me back to the video question, because we had a case where we did this interview with a 108-year-old earthquake survivor earlier this year. And that was a story where we really said to ourselves, we're going to go above and beyond and spend a lot more time and energy on this story than we would otherwise. And we found someone who's willing to sort of help out as a videographer and, you know, go up to Marin and do a whole long interview and edit the video and put it together. And that ended up being a super popular story for us that everyone really enjoyed, and we got a lot of great feedback on it. But that's just not the type of story that we have the resources to do, you know, except on a, you know, one-off situation where we really, really feel strongly that we wanted to do that. So, yeah, more resources would definitely equal more in-depth storytelling like that.
Todd?
There's a lot of stories that could be told more, but the ones where I really sort of feel it are, for example, there was a officer-involved shooting in Bernal Heights recently, Alex Nieto, when he was killed on Bernal Hill. That's the kind of story where it's really obvious to me that there is a story that needs to be told that hasn't been told, and the only way to tell that story is just through a lot of gumshoe reporting, just a lot of working the beat. And frankly, I just can't do that. And I'm sad about that, because that's such an important story. And yet we're very dependent at this point either on the traditional, you know, media to get to it eventually, or for the police to issue and the investigators to issue their reports. But it's just so obvious that there's a lot that needs to be said there. And if the resources were there, that'd be the kind of thing I'd really would love to dig into.
Roy, what about you and the Castro?
Well, the Castro has a lot of events that happen every week, and sometimes on a regular basis, and it's a very vibrant place. And I feel like coverage of some of these events would be awesome, like the film festivals that happen at the Castro Theater. I don't have time to go to those, but I think that a quick movie review and an invitation to bring people into the theater would be awesome. Also, we have the GLBT History Museum, which just opened up its new exposition, and going into there and doing a review of that would be awesome. Also, going to some of our many neighborhood association meetings and kind of reporting on what's going on there, because a lot of the stories I get for the Castro Biscuit are sourced from what's going on in the neighborhood associations. I subscribe to the newsletters. I get the paper newsletters in my mail and in the electronic in my email. And there's so much going on, and especially with housing right now, everyone wants to know what's happening. I'm not able to cover all of it. So having more resources in such a big area like the Castro, that's just the central part of the city, it's actually a really big part of the city, it feels like to me anyway. Having those resources to cover everything would be amazing. I think people would really love that.
Let's take a final station break. You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight we're discussing neighborhood journalism with my guests, Todd Lappin of Bernalwood, Rose Garrett of Hoodline, Kevin Montgomery of Uptown Almanac, and Roy McKenzie of the Castro Biscuit. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Again, the number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website, kalw.org. I'd like to go next to an email from Dahlia. And Dahlia writes, how do you engage communities of color from the neighborhoods you represent and write about, i.e., do you offer multilingual coverage? I do not know the background of most of the guests on the show, but I'm curious if they consider how to really represent a diverse range of voices and topics, especially considering the current moment we find ourselves in San Francisco, re-displacement, and the potentially well-positioned advantage hyper-local blogs can have.
I mean, as someone who writes primarily about the Mission, I mean, that's a huge pitfall of my site. I mean, and actually, I get this question a lot through email or through Twitter, where someone, you know, talks about why we don't talk more about what's happening in the Latino community of the neighborhood. And I mean, part of it's my background. I personally am not engaged in that community in any sort of way. And I think that's actually one of the really big problems in the neighborhood is that effectively it's a very segregated neighborhood. I mean, the Latino and Caucasian tech communities, I mean, all these different communities really don't integrate. And I found that's a really hard barrier to sort of cross. So never mind the multilingual barrier. I feel like a lot of the issues, I don't have any good contacts with those communities. And honestly, I feel like oftentimes there's some apprehension when, you know, someone like myself would come in and want to talk with them and report on their communities. And so in the mission, you actually have very segregated media. You know, myself is largely talking to, you know, primarily Caucasian housing activists, whereas El Tocolote is primarily talking about Latino issues. And then you have Mission Local, which is kind of a hybrid, but it's primarily now a defunded student newspaper that occasionally puts out a Spanish translation of their articles. So I do feel like that community, that voice is very underserved, but there's really, unfortunately, I don't think there's a good way for someone with limited resources, both in, you know, economic investment in the publication, but also just time to be able to bridge that gap.
Couldn't there be a way, though, to proactively reach out to some of these communities and say, if there are people who want to step forward and volunteer to post things and send them to you, to somehow get the word out and establish some level of trust to get other voices on? No, you can't pay them, but you're not getting paid yourselves.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a time thing for, you know, as we've all mentioned repeatedly, I mean, these sites are largely passion projects for all of us. I mean, it pays dividends and friendships and, you know, accolades. But like at the end of the day, you have to be really passionate about that. And while people might be very passionate about an issue, they might not have the time or energy to write, to, you know, do the reporting that it takes. And you know, having gone through a number of contributors over the years, you know, one of the things I find when someone starts to contribute on the site and, you know, quickly, they almost always, you know, stop within a month or two, either because they were, you know, surprised by how nasty the commenters were, or just the sort of, you know, the anxiety of having to write for a larger outlet than they, you know, they didn't have an opportunity to sort of like work their way up. And I've just found that getting other voices has been a really, honestly, it has been a dead end, unfortunately. And I haven't actually found a good way to solve that problem.
Well, maybe there's somebody out there listening tonight who would like to contribute, who can go to your blog and reach out to you. I assume you're all reachable from your blogs?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me let Rose or Todd, would you like to weigh in on this email?
Well, we actually do have a variety of contributors that we've sort of found over the time that we've been up and running, but it is a very work-intensive process to really find people who get over that sort of sexy, I want to write something moment, and then, you know, once you become acclimated to the grind, you know, it's there's a lot of anxiety and there's a lot of hard work that goes into it, and oh no, I have another deadline, and I don't know if I have a story. And you know, if you're not sort of hardened to that kind of thing, and if you're not you know, dedicated to doing this without any sort of real financial payoff, a lot of times for us, we work hard to kind of onboard people and then they disappear. That being said, you know, Hoodline has had some success finding great people to write for us. And I would like to just put a call out there. If you are someone who lives in any of our neighborhoods of coverage, which right now are Lower Haight, Upper Haight, and Hayes Valley, and sort of a Divisadero corridor area, you know, please get in touch with us. We would love to have you contribute or just, you know, hear your thoughts on things. So, yes, I'm optimistic.
I would echo a lot of what Kevin said. I'm definitely aware of that as a huge blind spot. Again, I have also, there's two things that I've sort of say about this. One, again, Bernalwood is sort of an open mic. So I've always said, you know, first of all, to overcome the very barriers you guys have both pointed to, I never tell people to write an article. They always say, I want to write for you. I say, don't write me an article. You'll never write it. Just send me an email. And that tends to work a lot better. Having said that, and I've said the same thing when this issue has come up of diver, you know, economic or racial diversity on Bernalwood, I don't get the emails. You know, I have asked for them quite a bit, and I've said, if there's something that you don't want to see here, you just need to send me an email, and it will definitely be reach the community, but it doesn't happen too much. The other thing I would say is that it's sort of like what Kevin was saying about the mission. Bernal already has an existing newspaper that's published bilingually, and sort of don't necessarily know that I'm going to be the best outlet for the best outlet to basically do something which is already being done quite well by our existing newspaper, the Bernal Journal.
Roy, what about you and the Castro?
Honestly, I'm kind of in the same position. I don't have the resources to access other voices in the neighborhood. I have had guest contributors in the past, four or five of them. They have a fiery passion. I've met with many people who have a passion to write, and they would like to contribute, but it does fizzle away quickly. I mean, the one minority, and which is a huge majority actually in the Castro, is the LGBT community. So it's I do end up doing a lot of coverage for that, but I also try to. I don't want the blog to be a queer blog, which is totally fine, and it's amazing. I like reading queer blogs, but I really want it to be about the neighborhood. And sometimes I have to strike a balance about like covering all this queer stuff because it is a queer neighborhood, and covering other stuff that I think is also important, like a new condo development going up, or maybe some formula retail issues. You know, as far as racial and economic diversity, there's stories to be told there, but I'm just not as connected as I'd like to be or have resources to be.
Well, Talia, we really appreciate your email, and I guess I would just put the word out again to those who are listening. If you would like your voice to be on one of these blogs and you live in one of the neighborhoods that I've mentioned here, please go to the blogs and reach out, and they'll keep their ears open for new voices that could potentially come from this broadcast this evening. Let me turn to how you fund these. Now, I believe at least one of you has advertising and others don't. Who does have advertising here? Okay.
Yeah,
how does that work?
Well, I mean, we have limited and advertising that's all sort of locally facing. If you go to the site, you'll see ads for Magnolia and the Alembic and Upper Haight and places like that, and that's something that we're definitely.
And are they banner ads, or what kind of ads are they?
They're not banner ads. They're sort of embedded in between sort of the down scroll. Mm-hmm.
Oh yes,
the site.
I saw those when I was checking it out. Yeah.
And we hope that's not too invasive or annoying for readers. But it's certainly something that we're thinking about and trying to figure out. But at this point, it's largely self-funded. I mean, it's just the way it is right now, but it's an ongoing conversation for us. You know, is it possible to sustain yourself doing this? I mean, no one really knows.
I'd like to see, hear from the rest of you. Todd?
I don't have any advertising on Bernalwood for a combination of not having the time to really figure out how I would get advertising on it, although there's some other reasons as well that sort of are more about a kind of an ambivalence. The ambivalence, one, is that because it's a passion, I found like when you have a hobby, there's no faster way to make it no longer make it fun than to make it your work. So as soon as I start to add money into the equation, I'm afraid that I will actually start to lose interest in it. Secondly, the people who would be the most natural advertisers are right now the subjects of a lot of my articles, and I just see that as a, you know, very quickly running into the conflict of interests. So it just seems like a cleaner, easier way to do it. The problem, of course, is sustainability, which is, you know, that Bernalwood and I think a lot of these blogs will exist as long as any of us have the passion and enthusiasm for doing it, and, you know, an economic model is sort of the key to sustainability, and none of us really have that.
Yeah, I mean, I've spent about, I mean, like 20, the blog is like $20,000 in debt in my case. I mean, I could put advertising on and might, you know, help sort of bridge the sort of burn versus, you know, income. But I mean, at the end of the day, like I've priced it out. Putting banner ads that are self-serve on the site won't make enough money to sustain its costs. And, you know, I have to consider, would I rather sort of maintain the credibility of not having ads on the site, which I think, I mean, as soon as you put ads on the site, I think people look at you and say, well, are you just trying to make money off of the sort of news that's happening in the neighborhood instead of just reporting on it? And the other factor is exactly what Todd said, you know, do I just take whatever random national ads from Visa or Enterprise Rent-A-Card or whoever else is just doing a big blanket Google ad buy, or do I try to work with local merchants to have them advertise on the site? While the local merchants might be more relevant, it does exactly put me in this conflict of interest, which means I can't objectively report on it, whereas larger media organizations have their editorial departments completely removed from the advertising divisions.
Roy, what about you?
Well, I think that I'm kind of with Kevin as far as, like, putting ads on my site I felt like would remove some of the trust that I've built with my readers. However, I like what Hateration does by reaching out to local, like, small businesses and trying to create some kind of useful advertising for their neighborhood. I think that's a really good model. Unfortunately, I don't have the time to really reach out to these businesses and try to convince them that, hey, this blog has this many hits, and, you know, if you advertise, you'll probably get a bump of business. I don't know how to quantify all that. It's a big process, and these small businesses that are trying to pay their leases or, you know, buy their goods, I think making a sell for a small blog in the neighborhood and trying to make that a valuable sell to them is a difficult process, and I just kind of throw my hands in the air and be like, nah, I'm not going to deal with it. I'm just going to write, and I'm going to let that be it. I think it does lend a sense of credibility, though, like Kevin mentioned, when you don't have ads on your site. It seems altruistic, although even then I've been accused of, like, being in the pocket of Supervisor Wiener or in the Castro Community Benefit District, and they're back funding me somehow, and that's not true. So
okay, Roy, we are just about out of time here. I just want to ask you each in one quick sentence, if there is someone in a neighborhood that does not have a local blog and they want to start one, what advice would you have for them? Just one sentence each, because we're almost out of time. Roy.
Start one on WordPress.com and then start a Twitter account and a Facebook account and tweet it out every single time.
Kevin.
Make friends with other editors.
Rose.
Be ready to work really hard with unknown payoff.
Todd, the last word.
Yeah, the best way to start one is to start one.
Okay, well, thank you all so much for joining me this evening. That's City Visions. My guests this evening were Todd Lappin from Bernalwood, Rose Garrett from Hoodline, Kevin Montgomery from Uptown Almanac, and Roy McKenzie from the Castro Biscuit. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Also, you will find links to all of these blogs on klw.org. If you go to that site, you can go forward and link to the blogs that were spoken about tonight. Our engineer this evening was Eric Jansen. Tonight's show was produced by Susie Britton. Join my co-host, Joseph Pace, next Monday as we discuss advances in health technology. This is David Onick. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.